Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Writing the Rapids, the show where I, Joe Bilecki, talk to writers about writing. Very often, those writers have been recommended to me by writers who have previously been on the show, or it's a rejoinder episode, which this is. We are once again rejoined by Logan Berry to talk about his new book, Doom is the House Without a Door, published through Inside the Castle. Logan Berry is the author of Ultra Theater, Volume 1, Casket Flare, Runoff Sugar Crystal Lake, and Transmissions to Our Toe. He lives in Chicago. Before we get into my conversation with Logan, let's remind you how you can support the show for just $2 a month. Patreon.com/NoisemakerJoe. You can get these episodes a little bit earlier than everybody else. You can send me a one-time donation on PayPal. paypal.me/noisemakerjoe. You can buy my book, it's called Tired, or if you don't want to spend any money, talk about us on social media, blog about us, mention us on your podcast, repost, like, subscribe, comment. All those things are very helpful as well. Now, without further ado, let's get into my conversation with Logan. I want to start out with just having you describe the book, introduce the book. What, in your opinion, in your estimation, is Doom is the House Without a Door?
Thanks, Joe. Doom is the House Without a Door is a conceptual horror book. The concept is this man has written this book, printed it on demand, and edited it over and over at the scene of a crime, and he, once the crime is complete and the book is to his satisfaction, he ends his life with the book as the centerpiece of this horrific situation that he's staged.
That's interesting. I like that. That is a good way to describe it. So this book, like your others, at least the others that I have read, makes use of the book layout skills of Mike Creo. And there are visual motifs throughout. There's a doorway that appears, this arch that appears throughout. And circles, Guro, distorted Guro images throughout as well. It's a very nice book to look at, and I was thinking as I was reading it, now that I'm, 7 years into this podcast or whatever, and kind of no longer blown away that a book can look like this. I think if people go back and listen to the first year, there's a lot of me being like, oh my goodness, I didn't, that sort of thing. So now I'm able to look at a book with these heavy visual components in addition to the prose and kind of really take into account how, or indeed if, they are complementing the story. And I know that, and we have talked before, that you are quite involved with the layouting process, or at least quite specific about what it is you want the book to look like.
Yeah. Well, congrats on 7 years. That's really exciting. Seems like a really vital conversation, continuous conversation that you're having. Yeah, definitely. So for this one, the way we kind of describe it is it's written and designed in character. So I chatted with Mike before he laid it out for several hours one day on a phone call and described various potentials for approaches, and I'd sent him several Google photo albums of different things to draw from. and talked about the character, talked about the situation. And then some of the materials were things that I'd collected for a long time. So for probably more than a decade now, I'd been collecting photo negatives from estate sales, eBay, farmers markets, where people just had photo albums for sale. I found real photos to be just too much of a bummer to hang on to, just like photo albums of someone presumably dead or who knows what. But the photo negatives had a haunting quality that I quite liked. And this felt like the right place for those photo negatives to go. So I sent him, in addition to a typed out manuscript with the whole book in it, so he could experience the text in that kind of raw format, in addition to it in a like Word doc. There was also a big box of all these photos of various things, photo negatives, and a lot of those are in the book. Imagining those as heirlooms or memories that the author is including as part of this ritual, or and that needs to be included in this crime scene.
I found the character to be quite fascinating. The idea that it's kind of written in character, designed in character, is interesting too. I appreciated how the book starts off with like kind of like a gentle way of making you complicit, just by asking you to breathe with it and saying like, let's sync our heartbeats. So without knowing it, you're really falling into his sort of thing, into his orbit or control. And the world that he describes is not unlike our own, but sort of like a hyper nightmarized version of the nightmare that we're participating in. The father-in-law calls me Mr. Mom, but he doesn't know that I have 30 freelance gigs. I understand that feeling quite clearly. Were you imagining a sort of different version of our world, or is he himself amplifying the horrors of post late stage crony capitalism?
That's a great question. I always imagined it as our world, and that this is a very solipsistic, cut off perception of everything going on around. This is a very isolated person who has a lot of walls against his family. So I did imagine it as our world. It is pure fiction to the extent that that's possible. Like the characters in my imagination are pretty well defined, even if he doesn't bother to describe too much, because we're sort of trapped within his orbit, as you so beautifully said earlier. It's a tricky thing, first person, because people want to jump to conclusions about the auto fiction or nonfiction elements, but it is, in my mind, a pure fantasy with real feelings that I was having, and real, well, I guess I'll lay my cards out. It relates to something we were talking before recording. When my first child was born, I was familiar with the fact that men have hormonal changes, like lowered testosterone, and other things like that. And from horror films, I was well familiar with postpartum depression and anxiety, specifically for the mom.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that men also can have that experience. And I have a wonderful wife who is a nurse, and I told her I was having intensive, intrusive thoughts. And she normalized it right away, said it, and encouraged me to do some reading on it and reaching out to other friends who are fathers. And at the time, it was 4 out of 5 of the other young fathers I talked to also had these intrusive thoughts. They were never something I felt like I was going to act on or anything like that. Mostly like just being surprised at the intensity of the thought. And some of the research suggests that it's a psyche and neurological rewiring to protect your child and reassess for danger and to become a good caregiver. And so utilizing this sort of negative explosive energy that I realized is okay to have, went about and wrote this book, very twisted book, to put the energy somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So the feelings, the intensive negative feelings, are the most personal part about it, but everything else is fabrication.
Sure. Yeah, I liked that as I kind of realized that it was a new dad book in a way. Really appreciated it. I asked back when it was Twitter, probably while my wife was still pregnant, for poets or novelists who write about fatherhood. And it didn't really get a good response. Johannes Jordansen was recommended to me, and he's been on the show, and I love his stuff. And his experience of fatherhood has been vastly different from my own. And so reading his work was illuminating. But yeah, the sort of the way this book reminds me of other motherhood books I've read, but from a father perspective, was really nice for me. You know, after I synchronized my heartbeat with this guy, like I was already, you know, a lot of the fatherhood stuff in there was familiar. One of the things I say to people a lot is that I love everything about being a father except for the world that I have to raise my kid in. And so, you know, the way that he is imagining this outside world, one of the things that really struck me was the wife's job, where she's making, like, she's working for some financial tech startup that's like speculating on future speculations or whatever. Just like the most kind of ridiculous tech startup venture capital sort of thing that you can imagine, where it's like you're gambling on how people are going to gamble in the future sort of thing. That kept me engaged. And then, I don't know, I'm already a fan of the sort of inside the castle isms, and the extreme horror isms that, I was really riding with the book the whole way. The interesting thing is, and I don't know if you do this, maybe you do, as people used to always threaten me with this idea of like, oh, you'll understand when you're a parent. When you're a parent, everything will be different. And while I absolutely understand the hormonal and neurological rewiring, I try to like gauge how differently I view, respond to art, right? Like, I remember watching Funny Games well before I was a father. I think before I was even married, watched Funny Games. And there's some pretty terrible stuff that happens to kids in that movie. A kid in that movie. Then I remember being like, wow, that's terrible. But, you know, also thinking like, or me thinking now, like, how would I respond to that movie if I had seen it for the first time now? And so when things start getting horror-y, I found myself, instead of like having the parent reaction, having this like outside, like, how am I responding to this sort of reaction? I've also written stuff that is unpublished where stuff happens to kids, where I do feel now like definitely keeping that unpublished and feeling like, oh, I probably wouldn't write anything like that. Like, I don't know if it has to do with being a dad now, that my desire to write as like horrific and depraved stuff as I can is mostly gone. But it is, right? Like, my desire to write dark stuff is still there, kind of just because that's like my aesthetic preference, right? That's like, that's the world I like to live in my brain palace is dark, spooky forests and crumbling castles and monsters and whatever. But yeah, so I guess I'm, all of that is getting around to a kind of dual question of, obviously you're writing this to get stuff out, but what did it feel like to write that? And then the other prong is, do you find that how you consume art has changed since becoming a father?
Oh, wow. These just such an excellent, excellent questions. Could respond in a number of ways. I guess I'll start with, the birth, viewing the birth and getting to be, do just as much, if not more, than the nursing student, as far as helping, you know, with the birth in the hospital with the midwives and stuff, was just a profound experience. To sort of clarify, and to potentially ward off any misconceptions about what I'm trying to say or how much I was involved with the actual birth, I'll say this: you know, the next day, I was doing squats in the hospital, and my wife was like, "Why are you doing that?" And I said, "Honey, you did 99.99999% of the work, but I'm a little sore after helping with that process." So to get that out of the way, I mean, she did the most, of course, but bearing witness to the birth was just, I mean, it's just so sublime, so overwhelming. It was the most incredible thing I've ever seen. I'd seen videos in preparation, educational. So I would, specifically, I wanted to see things go wrong and then be corrected so that I wouldn't be panicking or anything like that. So I'd seen that. Oh. And just seeing it in person, it's just, I can't think of any other way to describe it than it's like 80,000 sunrises at once. It's just totally overwhelming. So in the sleep deprived times after the baby came home, and all the hospital visits that you do right after they're born and acclimating and all the various things we do, my appetite for art was extreme. I wanted the most terrifying, beautiful stuff you could imagine. So I was watching Brian Pollan films. Mike Klein is the only film critic that I think matters to me. He was posting about Brian Pollan, this gentleman who makes these really low budget films on the East Coast. And he's just incredible. And I was watching a film called Bone Sickness that was just so, so moving, so dark. My appetite, you know, your arms are constantly occupied with the new parenting. So I was doing a lot of audiobooks and podcasts. And the only thing that could satiate me was just grisly true crime for whatever reason. So I like to think that I was just addicted to the beauty and extremity of and the complications of and the responsibility of bringing a new life into the world. But I had a real appetite for the sublime and the extreme. Now, by the other side of that is that didn't make me go onto eBay and seek out Peter Sotos or something that is deliberately cruel exactly.
Yeah.
That's not what I wanted. I wasn't interested in sod and evil exactly, but I definitely was interested. I guess the only word that keeps coming to mind are extremes, extreme beauty, extreme emotion, melodrama, extreme filmmaking. And consequently, the stuff I've written and the plays I've directed after have upped the ante in terms of that. And I don't know what to do with that, honestly. It's an ongoing complex that I'm working out personally and interpersonally with my wife, who doesn't like personally, like she respects the process and is supportive, but does not fuck with my recent stuff as much. And that's been okay, and that's been good, and it's actually brought us closer together, which is awesome, because it's forced us to confront different values and different ways of being together. So that's been good. The worst thing about that, though, is she's so supportive of this book and understands where it's from, and she's I share with her what others have said about it, because she's interested, but she, knowing where it came from and having gone through her own experiences, is not interested in reading it. And that's okay with me, and I respect that. The most selfish thing I can say about that is she's my prime reader. She's unsparing. She will let me have it if things are not good, if they're not up to par, if they're not working. And so I did go through a phase of being not so sure about this one, just because my best, most honest reader wasn't there from the get-go. So that's mostly for, I suppose, like an aesthetic and quality question. And getting blurbs, I was strategic of asking people who I knew would be honest, and I wanted to hear what they had to say. And so that gave me some confidence that it was a worthwhile project, because conceptually the work should probably be anonymous. If we were going to do the bit the whole way, it would make sense as an anonymous work. But I was like, should I read this? Weirdly, it's the easiest of my books to read out loud. It's sonically pleasing. It's less glitchy than some of the poetry. And based off of convos with some of the early readers, I'm like, okay, this is a worthwhile thing to put my name on and promote and sort of deny the bit a little bit in that regard. But in terms of ethics, I'm not sure. In terms of quality, I greatly appreciate your time with it and what you think, because I just, maybe it will always be this lack, since my spouse doesn't want to read it. So I'm always like, is this working? Is this doing what I want? So,
yeah,
I don't know. Did that answer?
It did. And that's interesting. I feel, with regard to the book, I definitely felt like this was the most solid, of what I've read, right? It's, trying to think. I want to say I kind of knew what was going on the most. You know, this is the third book of yours I've read. It felt the most like a novel. And I say that with the understanding that I love your other books too, right? I say it and people are going to, I'm afraid people are going to say, oh, that means it's the best one or something, because it's following more of the rules or something. And hopefully longtime listeners will know that that's not what I'm saying. But as I was reading it, I was much more kind of in the world, and was spending less time kind of like puzzling through what's going on like I did with Crystal Lake. And it felt like Casket Flare starts out as something and then becomes this other thing. The location changes and stuff happens, and I feel like this book as an object feels like the most focused as an entire object.
If I may, mm-hmm. You're totally legit response, and I completely agree. In a weird way, I see this as the secret trilogy that was Crystal Lake, Casket Flare, and Doom is the House Without a Door. Mm-hmm. I feel like Correo and I have been messing around with stuff, and that this was the most cohesive work. From my vantage point, I think it's the culmination of the three. So I agree with you for what it's worth.
Yes, cohesive is a good word, with the caveat and understanding that a book need not be cohesive to be a good book. It is interesting to me, also just your artistic desires post fatherhood changing in that way. I found myself, and this was, Isla was born like right before I turned 30. And like the day before Father's Day. But I found myself moving into my 30s, being like, I'm gonna really lean into the stuff about me that is uncool, and have largely stayed there for, you know, I'm 32 now. I've largely stayed there. So just being the Halloween year round guy, spooky stuff. Like I found that my aesthetic preferences, while still dark, continue to lean into fun. And as I want to share that with the kid, lean even further into kid friendly stuff. Like, we're not going to listen to Cancer Slug. We're not going to listen to every Misfits song together, but we're going to listen to some Misfits songs together. And we're going to, you know, there's a picture of her wearing my Cramps t-shirt, as a 1 year old. But I have also found and felt while you were saying it, like I can't handle stuff as much. I feel like I could sit through Funny Games. I feel like I could read a Peter Sotos book if I wanted to. I don't know too much about him aside from that his books are hard to get through, and that people who write intense stuff, who I have talked to, have also mentioned like not really enjoying or being able to get through his stuff. So I find that interesting, that like maybe just at this point reading Peter Sotos is just like a badge of honor, that like you can do the scary thing. But in the past like year and a half have started having panic attacks, and I've never had panic attacks before. Like there is an element of resilience that both to art and to the, I don't know, the normal day to day that is more difficult for me. But also in other ways, like getting more extreme, like I've gotten more into metal, than I really ever have been now. And part of that has to do with making friends with a guy at work who listens to a lot of metal and hardcore punk stuff. But yeah, I don't know. I'll also note that, as much as we tried to have a natural birth, it ended up being a C-section. So my labor and delivery experience is vastly different from yours. So yeah, I don't know. It was interesting to hear how it affected you differently, how you responded to things differently. I feel like having
a lot of them,
a wife and mother who works in healthcare is such a cheat code. That's so sick.
Yeah, she started in hospice and now she's labor and delivery, so she's really done the whole nine yards. But to be clear, it's the reason those questions really resonated with me, Joe, is because they are ongoing questions. Yeah. I'm not really sure what the future holds as far as that, all that stuff goes. Like, there's plenty of material on my bookshelves that will go into a private area when the children are wanting or reading for themselves. And
yeah.
And how do I say this? Some of that more difficult material is stuff that I wouldn't want to create an opportunity for them to accidentally find it. If they have that appetite or interest later on, then I may share, but none of this is stuff I wish to impose or expose anybody to. But at the same time, it's where my stuff is. So in that sense, the art process, the book writing, the theater making, it poses a lot of interpersonal and ethical questions that I think are good for my family, since they've decided that, since my child was forced to have me as a father by chance, and my wife chose to be there. So these are all ongoing things, and maybe if we talk some other time, I'll have a different response to it. And you know, I have a friend who I won't say their name, but you know them. And I know that when he had his first child, he got rid of all the Sotos books from his house. And I mean, to be fair to Sotos too, he has a lot of different books that have a lot of different things going on in them, but it's shorthand for a certain kind of provocation with regards to even the law. I mean, that's where Sotos first got started, was putting out things that created laws about certain kinds of censorship. So I don't want to be too dismissive or pigeonholing of what he does. And moreover, I guess extreme or sublime is another cheat code shorthand way of me to say, and I'm not actively seeking out cruelty per se, but the best movie I saw last year, a new movie, was Terrifier 3. And it was I went there opening night in Chicago, and it was a full-bodied experience that I hated the movie on the bus ride home. And then the next day I was texting people, you have to see this. This is the best movie I've seen in a long time. And there is a active engagement with extremity and cruelty and childhood memories and a real ugliness, like an ugliness that is not far away from this kind of conversation with children. And then also, I think maybe why Terrifier 3, maybe that's a good case study for something that I enjoy, because there, it's more than just the cruelty. There's a whole occult and biblical framework in it that's fascinating. I know that's polarizing for a lot of people, but it also, I think it adds dimension to this otherwise grindhouse, gore-houndy ugliness. So I guess that's what I want, is like the full range of feeling and emotion and consequences and all kinds of stuff. So again, sorry if this was a little bit all over the place, but it's just something that's still being worked out. And I don't know how Doom Is the House Without a Door fits into this conversation exactly. But maybe if I may pivot, there's some like real formalist elements to it. I imagine the guy who wrote it writing some poetry, and they do follow a structure. It's the hymnal format, which Emily Dickinson used. It's just a little bit more unfaithful than hers. I call it broken hymnals. And you should be able to read a lot of them to the tune of Amazing Grace. So, and same with Emily Dickinson poems. So I haven't done it for all of them, but some of them do fit into that. So there's more than the emotion and the cruelty. There's other things going on in this book that may interest people in giving it a gander. It's been fun to see like a couple Instagrams and a couple Goodreads. It's definitely the most negative initially, which I think is good. I think that it's a book with a lot of ugliness in it. So I'm hopeful more people will read it, because again, I'm craving people's responses to it, good and bad.